From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. In the history of art and ideas, the communication of the sacred by way of words and images is a theme of continuing interest. How do societies express and understand the sacred in art and language? That question is central to the following two discussions on soundings. This week, a conversation about Gothic art and architecture in medieval England and Europe. Next week, a discussion about the sacred in words and images in early Christian culture in the Mediterranean. The Soundings panelists this week are Roger Stalley of Trinity College in Dublin, Ireland, and Lawrence Hoey of the University of Wisconsin at Milwaukee. Soundings next week will include two scholars from Duke University. A combination of structure, function, and delight. That's how Roger Stalley and Lawrence Hoey characterize medieval Gothic art and architecture, a blending of the aesthetic, the liturgical, and the practical. According to Roger Stalley and Lawrence Hoey, the economic expansion of medieval Europe helped make possible the financing and construction of Gothic cathedrals. These immense buildings served broadly social as well as specifically religious functions, by way of communicating and combining the sacred and the secular. During recently completed fellowship years at the National Humanities Center, Roger Stalley and Lawrence Hoey worked on projects about early English art and society. Roger Stalley, Larry Hoey, we are talking about Gothic architecture. We've got what Roger characterized before our conversation as really a nightmare of a problem trying to define the word itself. Let's begin with that. Larry, give me, again, before our taping session for Soundings, you mentioned that there are, at least three ways to approach this notion of the Gothic. I think, for example, of Quasimodo pouring molten lead on a crowd in an old movie. I think also of Duke University, which is famous for its Duke Gothic. As art historians, how do you come to this word?
Well, again, you could define it according to as a style. You could define it in geographical context. You could define it structurally. Uh-huh. All of these are concerns that people have had in various periods. In fact, when you mentioned Victor Hugo, you're really talking about a Romantic view of Gothic, which is one of the first appreciations of Gothic. And then later in the 19th century, you get, with the rise of engineering and technology, you get men looking at Gothic buildings and appreciating them structurally. Mm-hmm. And that still is certainly one of the major ways of looking at Gothic. But then there's also intertwined with all of these things an aesthetic consideration as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, we think the buildings are beautiful, great works of art. Mm-hmm. Whether we think that because they are structurally so elegant, or whether we think that it doesn't have necessarily to do with structure is something else. So in defining Gothic architecture, one has to beware of all of these various categories.
Uh-huh. Roger Stalley, is it too much, is it too far-fetched to say that that Gothic architecture represents a school, a way of, an aesthetic way of approaching engineering and the combination of engineering and art?
Well, I think it's true to say that for most casual visitors to a great Gothic cathedral, the most amazing, impressive thing which strikes them is the engineering achievement. Particularly, this is so in France, in the great cathedrals like Chartres and Bourges, mm-hmm. and Amiens and so on, where you have a structural system which consists of having a stone vault, stone ceiling, in effect, across the cathedral, something in the order of 100, maybe 120, 130 feet above the ground, suspended there. And that, I mean, by the terms of contemporary engineering, is an incredible achievement.
Hundreds of tons of stone, in other words.
Oh, yes, exactly, uh-huh. exactly. And, of course, the French Gothic architects evolved this particular structural system in order uh-huh. to support the vaults, involving the flying buttresses on the outside of the building.
Well, let's come back to some definitions. Again, Roger Stalley from Trinity College, Larry Hoey from the University of Wisconsin. What do you look for? What are the primary characteristics in Gothic architecture? I think, for example, of gargoyles, that sort of thing.
Too much Victor Hugo, I think.
Obviously, I'm not doing the topic justice. Larry?
Well, the traditional way, the traditional stylistic characteristics or structural features were generally thought to be rib vaults, that is, the roof of the building supported on thin bands of stone that are crisscrossed, and then the areas between these ribs are filled in. This was a structural method that the 19th century admired a great deal for its economy, and because the lines of the building were, I mean, the structural lines of the building were made visible, obviously something that international style architects in the 20th century were very fond of as well. And this has encouraged a very structuralist view of Gothic architecture. There are, however, also people who look at the ribs as aesthetic and think that although they may have helped make the actual construction easier in terms of wood centering, that they don't actually help support the building once the building is complete. Mm-hmm. And in fact, recent studies of a highly technological sort.
Mm-hmm. Now, Larry Hoey has used the word structure a couple of times. Roger, were the architects, the engineers, was that the principal concern? Did the aesthetic characteristics of Gothic sort of follow?
This, as Larry has just explained, is one of the great debates, trying to decide which comes first. Uh-huh. Is it some sort of artistic image that the architects have in mind, and then the structure has to fall around this and be created in order to achieve it?
Well, where did the architects get their ideas? Did they think of themselves as artists or as artisans, as builders? How do you figure out that relationship?
I think the latter more. I don't think we should have too elevated an idea of the Master Mason. He was basically a practicing craftsman, and one of the big differences between the architect in the Middle Ages and the architect today is that he not only designed the building, indeed often carried the design almost literally in his head, because drawings were not widespread, certainly at this, and weren't used a great deal at this time, but he was also responsible for the actual building of the cathedral or
church. Supervised it.
He supervised the construction down to the last detail. And we know this from a particularly intriguing anecdote to do with the building of Canterbury Cathedral in the 1170s, when the master mason involved there, William of Sens, actually fell very nearly to his death when he was involved in constructing the stone vaults, some 70 or 80 feet above the floor of the cathedral. So it's a very interesting detail which shows us that the master mason was actually there supervising the completion of the vault.
Just parenthetically, Roger Stalley from Trinity College and Larry Hoey from the University of Wisconsin were talking about Gothic architecture. Were there a lot of accidents? In other words, my larger question is this. We think of ourselves today as what? Very sophisticated architecturally and in terms of engineering. Are we doing the Gothic architects and artists an injustice by thinking that way about ourselves? Were they as able, as competent as we are today? Larry Hoey.
I think, yes, that's true. I think that just as modern engineers sometimes experience failures of various sorts, so Gothic builders certainly experienced failures. But what's remarkable is that given the lack of predictive ability they had in terms of they had no computer models, they had very elementary math, in fact, and much of what they did was based on trial and error. Something stood up, it worked, and you repeated it, or you might modify it according to what strains are appearing in the fabric.
So there weren't a lot of accidents, I take it. Roger?
Well, there may well have been. It's just that we don't hear about them in the in the literature, and of course, once an accident has happened, the cathedral building is reconstructed. In fact, I have a hunch, but it's impossible to prove, that one of the greatest developments in Gothic architecture may well have come about through an accident. And I refer to the flying buttress. These are these great arches on the outside of a cathedral which help to support the forces and the outward thrusts of the stone vaults inside the building. Within relatively few years, they worked out what was the best place to have these flying buttresses. And we know from modern studies that they more or less got it right.
Who did the architects take their orders from? We have this very complex mixture of society and art and engineering. We have religious forces at work here. We have economic forces at work. Describe for me this interplay in the construction of Gothic cathedrals. Larry, you want to take a shot at that?
Well, it's very difficult to know because we don't have that many documents. We don't have all of the written evidence that one has even for the Renaissance, say. So a lot of this we just simply don't know. We do know, certainly, that the patron was very important. He was the man who was providing the funds.
Now, this would be what, royalty?
Well, in most medieval churches, it would not. It would be the bishop or uh-huh. the abbot, presumably. But these were also very busy men. Politically, they were generally involved in all sorts of negotiations, and it's unlikely that they would have taken detailed interest in the building. On the other hand, they certainly would have had opinions, make it big, uh-huh. or make me so many altars. We just don't know. We don't have these kinds of directives left.
Are these buildings, Roger Stanley, are they memorials to individuals? Larry Hoey has just mentioned the whole system of patronage, bishops, that sort of thing. Do we have here a sort of egotistical exercise on a very large scale going on?
I think you're right, we do. Probably at two different levels. One is unquestionably the patron was partly concerned with extolling his own prestige, and I'm sure that's true for many medieval bishops. But there's a second factor involved, which is that the excuse for much of the rebuilding that went on in the Gothic period, this is particularly evident in England, was the construction of part of the building almost as a shrine for one of the saints. Usually the local saint mm-hmm. Of the particular cathedral or abbey. And so the excuse for indulging in a very ambitious and expensive piece of construction was that you were, as it were, embellishing the shrine mm-hmm. of, well, it could be St. Etheldred, or it could be almost any of the local saints of England or France.
Thomas a Becket, for example.
Well, that's a very interesting case because literally within a few years of Becket's death, the Cathedral of Canterbury underwent a massive reconstruction, partly, of course, on the proceeds that the pilgrims left behind. It, in a way, the fire which destroyed Canterbury Cathedral 4 years after Becket's death was very fortuitous because it gave the monks of Canterbury a heaven-sent excuse to reconstruct the cathedral in a very grand way with the money, with the aid of all the money which the pilgrims were bringing them.
Larry Hoey from the University of Wisconsin, Roger Stanley from Trinity College. We're talking about Gothic architecture. Let's pause on that notion of money and finances and economics for a couple of moments. Where did the money come from? Roger has just mentioned the pilgrims. Earlier in our conversation, Larry mentioned the bishops. Again, describe this in generalities for me. Who built these things, and were they paid for before the fact? Do we have these enormous mortgages that go on and on, Roger?
Yes, clearly there were mortgages, and there were the cathedral authorities, the abbeys particularly, took out loans. We hear of this because in the later part of the 12th century there are references in the documents to a number of the Cistercian abbeys in England being heavily in debt to the Jews. So it does seem to have operated somewhat like a modern mortgage. But the basic revenue which an abbey or cathedral had depended on its landed endowment, and that was always, I think, the core of the financing of a large building. It's worth mentioning too, of course, that the sin of usury, of lending money, was something Christians were not, in theory anyway, allowed to do. And so that's why the Jews, of course, were there in the role of money lenders.
All right, now Larry Hoey, you've mentioned I don't want to use the word tension, but the interplay between the aesthetic and the structural. What was the function of the inside of the Gothic cathedral? That's pretty obvious, I suppose. What, educational, the evocation of spirit and religion, all of that, Roger?
A lot has been made of the educational role of the cathedrals, particularly when they have elaborate programs of sculpture and stained glass. The stained glass is often filled with very detailed scenes, often extremely erudite. And I'm a little bit skeptical about the educational role of the cathedral. We're often in the standard textbooks given the image of, as it were, one of the clergy there standing with a group of laity expounding the scriptures from the stained glass. But in fact, I just don't think this ever happened.
And these would be people who were illiterate, for one thing. Continue that for me.
Yes, the stained glass windows, again, they're often described as a kind of picture book Bibles.
Right.
But in fact, if you stand, shall we say, in Chartres Cathedral and try and study the individual scenes in the glass, it's exceedingly difficult The scale is very small. They're well off the ground. And after a couple of minutes or so, your eyes are all screwed up and it's just far too hard work.
Yeah.
And I can't believe it was any easier in the 13th century than it is today when we have binoculars and so on to help us.
So this is what, art for art's sake? I mean, these elaborate designs and the glass work on the insides of these cathedrals was what, purely aesthetic?
Well, I think it's Larry? Going too far to say purely aesthetic. Certainly someone was laying down a program saying, depict this saint's life and put it here. But I think the end result, in a way, might be aesthetic. Certainly there's lots of sculpture. At Reims Cathedral, for example, high up in the building, there are huge statues, which one can see from the ground, but there's no way you can make out the detail or sometimes even identify the figures.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to the first of two discussions about communicating the sacred in art and in language. The topic on Soundings this week is medieval Gothic art and society. My guests are Roger Stalley of Trinity College in Dublin, Ireland, and Lawrence Hoey of the University of Wisconsin at Milwaukee. According to Roger Stalley and Lawrence Hoey, the period of High Gothic style is the first half of the 13th century in Europe, a classic moment in the interplay between art and engineering, aimed at broadly social as well as specifically liturgical functions. Roger Stalley and Lawrence Hoey have both completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center. Roger Stalley is the author of a forthcoming study about regional expressions of early English style. Lawrence Hoey worked on a project entitled Pier Design in Early English Gothic Architecture. Here is Roger Stalley.
The cathedral, a great cathedral in a town, was very much a multi-purpose building. First of all, it was a great status symbol for the bishop and the church in general. But also, particularly the nave of the church, that is the part stretching westwards, the longest part of the building, that tended to be used as a general meeting hall, and we shouldn't imagine it perhaps in the way that we think of a church today. And then the monks or the canons, whatever they may be, would be fairly well secreted up at the east end of the church near the altar. In fact, there was normally a dividing screen, often a very high screen, separating them off from the rest of the building. And then another important component in this would be any shrine or reliquary that the cathedral might possess, and that perhaps be behind the high altar, or might have its own particular area of the building behind the high altar. So it's very much a multi-purpose building. And one of the problems that historians have to try and sort out is the extent, as Larry mentioned, to which these liturgical and spiritual considerations, to what extent they actually molded the plan of the building, but also the actual general design. And a fair amount of research has been done on that in the last 10 years or so. Interesting research, but I think it's still very debatable, really, whether this had a profound impact on the actual appearance, the ultimate appearance of the building.
Just a quick question here. We're talking about Gothic architecture. Larry Hoey from the University of Wisconsin, Roger Stalley from Trinity College. How long did it take to build one of these things? Did the art historians nail that down? Was it just unpredictable, Roger?
Yes, it was, and it depended, of course, entirely on cash. A rich cathedral could probably build fairly quickly, and again, an outstanding case is Canterbury Cathedral, building fast on the proceeds of Becket's death, in effect, and they got a very elaborate choir erected in the space of 10 years. So it's anything from 10 years to 200, 300, 400 years.
What should a modern, a tourist, a modern audience, I was going to say, what should we look for in these buildings? What is there that we should be aware of in order that, as we discuss them, we have a difficult problem. We're on the radio talking about architecture, but ideally, as we visit these places, what should we be aware of? Roger Stalley.
Well, I tell my students now to almost imagine looking at a cathedral is like looking at a book, and that just as you read each line in turn, so they should be ready to take a great deal of time and patience looking at the details, as well as capturing, of course, the overall effect. So you might even begin literally at the bottom, looking at the way the piers which support the whole superstructure. You look at the the relationship between the pier and the ground, because a Gothic architect, a medieval architect, didn't just, as it were, plonk his great pier on the floor. In fact, there are transitional features, a base, a plinth, often very attractively molded and carved. And these designs change over a period of a few years, and this is one of the ways that we are able to, as it were, plot the development of style.
What did these buildings mean to ordinary, everyday people? They were religious symbols, I take it. They were icons in the social structure. Do you trace things like that as you look at Gothic architecture, Larry?
Well, again, that's a virtually impossible question to answer because we don't have the evidence what the common man thought.
People just
in
didn't
the 13th
write this
century.
Stuff. Well, they didn't
people
write.
Couldn't write.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so those people who could write were the men basically who built the churches and had very specific views of them.
Mm-hmm.
So as with so much social history in the Middle Ages, we just simply don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Not only don't we know what they thought, but even how they necessarily used the buildings or mm-hmm. what access they had to the buildings.
Mm-hmm.
These are just very difficult questions.
Mm-hmm. Roger Stanley.
Yes, I'm sure Larry is right in that we are completely really in the dark about what the layman thought, except I suppose the only way we can judge it is by our own reaction in going into one of these buildings
mm-hmm.
today, which is, I think, of being overwhelmed by the scale, almost an emotional impact.
Yeah.
And that must have played on the common man and had an effect on him, either at a religious level or at a social level. The force, the power of the church
mm-hmm.
was so obviously impressed on him by these great buildings.
Mm-hmm. Roger Stanley from Trinity College, Larry Hoy from the University of Wisconsin. We're talking about Gothic architecture, not so much with your professional colleagues as with your students and just general audiences that you deal with, people that you talk to who aren't specialists. Are there misconceptions about Gothic architecture? Are there? I began the conversation by only half jokingly referring to Quasimodo and Victor Hugo and things like that. Are there stereotypical kinds of notions that you think need to be offset? Roger?
Yes, there are. I mean, one view that I encounter a great deal is that because we know the names of very few architects and because we don't know very much about the design processes, it's assumed that somehow this was all rather an amateur show
huh.
and that the sort of level of professionalism, which obviously was involved in building, just didn't exist. But also another element that one gets, particularly from those who've studied Renaissance architecture, is somehow that the layout of the buildings, the sort of geometry used, was almost arbitrary and irrational. But we know, again, from research carried out, well, really over a long period of time, over the last 100 years or so, that very intricate proportional systems were used, in fact, to work out the designs. It was a much more sophisticated design method than I think our students would believe when they first come to the subject.
We're not giving these people enough credit, in other words. Larry?
I would agree. I think for those people who actually see Gothic cathedrals, it's very difficult to think of their builders as amateurs.
Uh-huh.
But studying it from a distance, as most American students do, it is something that you need to impress on
mm-hmm.
them. I think it's interesting when we think of modern style, the international style, which was also a style that saw itself very much as a structural style and a style that expressed structure without any decorative frills. And I'm not an expert by any means on international style, but I think there was a certain way in which these men saw themselves as or similar to Gothic builders. And yet
huh.
I think that's an anachronistic view that they themselves were putting their own interpretation on Gothic. Gothic is a decorative style in many ways. Certainly some faces of it are almost entirely decorative.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have postmodernism, which supposedly is going back to historical sources and incorporating them in modern buildings, although generally I think more classical than Gothic sources.
Mm-hmm.
And so here we have a different attitude. Certainly modern architects are still obsessed with this idea of style and what is style for a specific period and can you make historical references. Questions that I don't think Gothic architects necessarily were so concerned about, although again we don't really know.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's interesting seeing modern architects struggling with how to relate to this inheritance. But I don't think there's a consensus by any means.
Mm-hmm. Roger?
Yes, I think one of the most absorbing things about Gothic architecture is the fact that historians today are still arguing about whether a particular feature was there for a structural reason, an aesthetic reason, a symbolical reasons. In other words, the architecture, as it were, mixes together so many different factors so skillfully that it's very hard to disentangle them.
Mm-hmm.
Structure, function, and delight, to use a Renaissance phrase,
mm-hmm.
Are so cleverly entwined,
mm-hmm.
That I think that's one of the great appeals of this architecture.
Sure,
as a stylistic phase.
It's like American television, entertainment and information at the same time. Just give me very quickly, by way of conclusion here, Roger Stalley and Larry Hoy, name one of these cathedrals and tell me why it sticks in your memory. What is it that's memorable about it for you? Roger?
I think I would probably pick Lincoln Cathedral in England.
Mm-hmm.
It's largely a 13th century cathedral, and what sticks in my mind, I suppose, are the first of all the wonderful vaulting, the patterns in the stone vault up above, also the intricacy of the lines on the piers and the arch mouldings. It's very, very rich in that sense, and also I think the colour, because English architecture of this period employed often two types of stone, in this case a polished marble, dark marble stone, contrasting with a much lighter limestone.
Huh.
So the effect of the colour and the patterning of the lines and, of course, the sheer scale of the building is unforgettable.
Larry?
Well, since Roger took an English example, I suppose I should take a French one. Laon Cathedral in northern France, which is a late 12th century, early Gothic, cathedral sticks in my mind, perhaps for rather different reasons, some that are the same, some that are quite different. It doesn't have color. It's very much of a single color. On the other hand, it does use some of the same features in terms of shafts to articulate walls and very intricate patterns, but very logical, very regular, repeating patterns, which is quite different from Lincoln, which has many irregularities. That's the kind of clarity and visual logic that one feels at Laon, and also the sense of space, and each story of the building quite open as well, that to me typifies the 12th century type of French Gothic, which I find very attractive.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to the first of two discussions about communicating the sacred in words and in images. The topic of the preceding conversation was Gothic art and society in medieval England and Europe. The Soundings panelists were Roger Stalley of Trinity College in Dublin, Ireland, and Lawrence Hoey of the University of Wisconsin at Milwaukee. During recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center, Roger Stalley and Lawrence Hoey worked on forthcoming books about early English Gothic art and society. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Early English Gothic Art and Society, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week, the concluding segment of Soundings on Communicating the Sacred in Words and Images. The topic will be early Christian culture in the Mediterranean. The Soundings panelists will be Anne Epstein and Robert Gregg of Duke University. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Listen to Soundings. This is Kim Nielsen at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join Wayne Pond for the first of two discussions about communicating the sacred in words and images. This week on Soundings, a conversation about early English Gothic art and architecture. Next week, a discussion about early Christian culture in the Mediterranean. Communicating the sacred in words and images. Featuring scholars from Trinity College, Dublin, Ireland, the University of Wisconsin, and Duke University, this week and next on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.